Thank you all for coming on this cold day. Dudananam, welcome. It's nice to see you. Happy New Year to everybody. This is the first meeting of the year, and I'm happy that we're doing it on the economy. As I said, it's a subject that doesn't always get the attention that it deserves. If you look at the headlines, most of the headlines is that the stock market is riding high, the Turkish lira is stable, and that things look good. And when the Prime Minister was here, when he had his meeting with the President, they talked about putting the economic dimension into the model partnership. All this is very good, but we haven't looked at the Turkish economy for a long time, and we're lucky to have Dr. Baran Tuncer with us. He's been kind enough to come to us before, and I've asked him to have a look at the Turkish economy in the coming year. This is the end of the first week of 2010. He can look back, as no doubt he will, to 2009, and then also very much hope that he'll look forward to 2010. He really doesn't need any introduction, but as I said in the invitation, after a long period at the World Bank, he's maintained his links to Washington. Prior to that, he was a professor of economics at Boğaziçi, and we were talking about some of the distinguished students that he had, including Enis Berberoğlu, who recently took over as Hürriyet, as well as many other economists and people who worked in government. He currently writes for Radikal. I read his columns regularly. He had one just last week, which I found very interesting. So, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Baran Tuncer to CSIS again, and to his review of the Turkish economy in 2010. And afterwards, hopefully we'll have, there's a lot of expertise in the room, hopefully we can have an exchange between you and our speaker. Dr. Baran Tuncer, welcome to CSIS again.
It's very nice to be back here. I often come here as I visit Washington time and again, either as a listener, participant of some of the very interesting meetings CSIS conducts, and at times I have had the opportunity to share some of my thoughts regarding the Turkish economy, and this is one of them. Now, today what I want to do is, clearly this is not a prepared lecture, you understand, I hope. Bilan told me, 2 days ago or yesterday, can you do it like this?
But of course.
That's wonderful. Anyway, so my thoughts may not be as disciplined as I would they would have been if I had longer time to think about these things. But in any event, this is a group who knows Turkey, obviously, intimately, and I look forward to some exchange regarding some of the developments and the interpretation of those developments. So what I want to do today is two things. One is, first, I want to make a very brief summary, so to speak, bringing out the more recent economic developments in Turkey. I suppose you are following it, but let me just remind us what the most recent figures regarding the economy indicate. First of all, it's quite clear that there are signs that the decline in the economy is slowing down. How do we know that? Third quarter decline in the economy was 3.3%, and this was coming down from 14%, 10%, et cetera, for the previous quarters. So this indicates a somewhat slowing down of the decline. But of course, one has to take into account the fact that the base year is very important here, and the base figure for the previous year was also a minus, so this year it looks not so bad. Now, positive growth is expected in the fourth quarter, for which the figures are not available yet for gross domestic product, and the year will possibly end with around a 6% decline, minus growth, for year 2009. What to expect growth-wise in the coming year again, the economists in different organizations think that about 3.5% is not a very far-fetched expectation for the economy. One reason for optimism is the growth figure for the industrial sector in October, which was a positive growth, recording positive growth. However, the use of industrial capacity is still very problematic, and the expectations of the consumer and the industrial leaders, again, are not all that optimistic. So we would expect, given these facts and figures, that there will be some growth in the coming year, barring some catastrophic events in Turkey. But in any event, we will probably follow the course that's taking place in all around the world in terms of recovery. I don't want to go into the exports, imports, etc. I don't want to crowd our conversation with that, but we all know that there have been major declines in exports and more so in imports, and the percentages are now showing, for example, for the current account deficit, about 80% less than the previous year. Now, what I like to point out or emphasize more is the budget. Now, the budget deficit in 2009 has grown after a few years of, or some years of, restraint on the part of expenditures. Now, for example, the recent figures we have available are covering 11 months for 2009, and expenditures have gone up by about 20% during this period, while the revenue growth was almost nil. Now, this is a point I like to emphasize, because this is going to be something which will preoccupy the government and all those interested in the coming year. Is Turkey once again going back to the days of larger budget deficit, and how the budget deficit will be covered, and what the implications would be? On the inflation front, the year ended with a 6.5% consumer price index increase, which is slightly more than expected, but also there are indications that there may be some upward movement in prices in year 2010. So realistically, I think one can expect some increase in interest rates in the coming period, and also some inflation. I guess the sorest spot in the Turkish picture is the employment situation. And for that, we have figures up to August of 2009. And those figures indicate a 13.4% unemployment compared to a 10.7% a year before that. In other words, 2008 in August showed 10.7% unemployment. Now it's 13.4%. And non-agricultural unemployment is much higher. It's about 17%. And for seasonal reasons, we expect these figures to go up, because we have just gone through the most active season with tourism and services and all that. Now, once again, unemployment may hit the levels of 16, 17%. Now, this is sort of a snapshot of the most of what the last recent figures are indicating, what's happening in the economy. We are looking ahead for a sluggish economic growth, even though it should be positive. And employment-wise, we can't expect much improvement there. But the areas we have to really look at carefully, the area, I should say, is what is happening to public finances and its implications on the economy. It was understandable that in 2009, like in most countries, Turkey, the fiscal policy was laxed. That was necessary. But the key point now is that will Turkey be able to pull it together in 2010 and restore some kind of stability so that we don't fall back to the times, say, in mid 2000, like 2005 and all that, where we suffered a great deal because of an increasing public debt burden. Now, having sort of reviewed of recent developments, what I really like to do today with you is to go back these 10 years, what has happened in Turkey, and why it happened so. Are there any lessons to learn from that? And what this past 10 years' experience has taught us and what we should expect in the coming years. I, for one, as an economist, even though I follow the stock market and the exchange rates, et cetera, closely, I am much more concerned about the medium to long term. Maybe that's my background also. I mean, it leaves me a little cold when I see all the economists are talking about the day-to-day things, and or if it's future, it's next month or next 3 months or next year. But really, will Turkey ever be able to raise its growth level to its potential and sustain it there? So what we have done or what we have gone through in this last decade, I think, should teach us something in that respect. Clearly, we had a very interesting 10 years with the change in the power, political power. Other things have changed in the area of economics as well. Now, one interesting figure is the growth in this period. We spoke a great deal about the rapid increase in the growth rate and all that, and something that is very much received with almost jubilation in some Western circles, how great Turkish economy was doing, sort of. But when the figures are down, we see that during this 10 years period, growth averaged about 3.3%. I accept the fact that the first year of this 10 years and the last year were times of crisis, but still, it is not really an exceptional period, 3.3%, especially when you compare it with the 90s and 80s. In the decades of the 90s, it was about 3.8% average growth. In the decade of the 80s, it was about 4%. I mean, in those decades, we also had ups and downs. It wasn't always a rosy picture. In the 90s, we lived crisis, et cetera, et cetera. But again, even though I can see and recognize that there was an interim period there, the Turkish economy grew rather rapidly, but the overall performance isn't exactly what it's made to believe. And especially when you look at the figures, you realize that beginning 2007, the economy sort of lost some of its energy. So it's not that the crisis that began, let's say, mid-2008 that caused this decline, but Turkish economy was performing less than what it was able to do in the previous years. Sort of kind of energy was lost. So growth-wise, in summary, this wasn't a decade of exceptional growth. Admittedly, some important changes have taken place during this time. Inflation rate was lowered. This is a major accomplishment from the hyperinflation and high inflation in the earlier decades and years. inflation came down drastically. And in a way, what was remarkable also, this does not really affect the growth rate either. There were some productivity gains in the economy, no doubt. This was mostly on account of, or at the expense of employment. The firms found it much more profitable, advantageous to get rid of some of the labor, so that if you define a productivity on a labor basis, there is some improvement during this period. And the firms have learned to live in a more competitive world and have become somewhat more competitive. The share of the public sector has declined in the economy. This was also a major change with the sales of or privatization of many firms. The government has not gone into any undertaking in this area. So this also was an important change. Some discipline was brought to budget, as I mentioned. But probably more importantly, the banking sector was strengthened under strict regulations and monitoring. I lived some of this period myself because of what I was doing in Turkey. And remember how we in the banking sector were extremely careful, while at the same time we had regulators continuously looking over our shoulder. So there was hardly any room for making a major mistake in this area. And this has paid off. And this was probably what saved Turkey from disaster at the time of crisis. I don't even want to imagine what Turkey would have gone through if it had also a corrupt or totally weak banking sector. That's what probably saved Turkey. But again, a major problem was that unemployment never ceased to get any lower levels. It persisted. It will continue to persist. Now, these are again some very general observations regarding what happened in the 1990s. But let me go a little bit into the sort of analysis of what happened there. And I know this is redundant for Bülent because he says he read my most recent article, but I'm sure none of you read it other than him. So it will be some.
A lot of people have read it.
So it will be some.
If you haven't, I think you're missing out on something.
No. So some of it will be repetition for you there. Now, let's just go back early 2000, the years of 2000. Turkey entered the decade with a major economic crisis. And I won't go through the events that led to it or that followed it, but Turkey at that time had to eventually implement a very strong program and a very tough one, tough for everybody involved. The wage earners and even some small business owners, etc., etc. Now, the then coalition government took the bitter pill and did all these. However, it cost them the power. They lost. Totally they lost. The leaders changed. Some of them came back. But all these economic events led to the coming of a new government under the AKP. And clearly what sort of what helped most the Justice and Development Party was the economic situation and the hardships that it imposed on different groups of people. So as a result, the coalition parties lost election in 2002, end of 2002. And the party in power first went through some hesitation. For a couple of months, we heard that they were not about to continue with the IMF program, or they are going to do things differently. But in a few months, they came to their senses and saw that there was no other course at that time. Stability was the main problem in Turkey, in the economy. And to their credit, they followed the agreements and the map, so to speak, the roadmap that was put before them. And they did implement it. Now, during this time, as I said, we have all observed some growth in the economy. But what was behind that growth? In addition to economic and political stability, this was a period, as we all know, everybody else was growing, not just Turkey only. Everybody, by that I mean not only the countries like China or India, but the growth rate was fairly respectable in the US and, more importantly, in Western Europe. Now, as you again all know very intimately, that there was a period of an abundance of liquidity in international markets, and the money was flowing to countries where it felt that the gain was the highest. So Turkey, during this time, received a lot of short-term and long-term capital. Now, what made this capital movements even stronger is the policy of the Turkish government, which was, as usually summarized or described, as the high-interest, low-exchange rate policy. It was very profitable for the fund managers all over the world to come and bring their money in Turkey and make this tremendous interest revenue and then convert that at a very low exchange rate, and during which time all sorts of resources of Turkey or gains of Turkey was transferred from Turkey. We never really wanted to see that, how much we were losing in the process. But this policy of high interest, low exchange rate also was attractive for the finance ministry or the treasury, to say it more correctly, since we have somebody from the treasury, and central bank. Why? Well, borrowing was relatively easy, and what was happening was helping the inflation a great deal, importing this rather inexpensive, cheap imports from abroad. But interestingly, this also was a policy that was very much in the short-term interest of the public, because the public now had a chance or had access to low-cost imports. So they found that their money went farther with this policy. So that it was a kind of an interesting coalition, a very strong coalition. Government was for it, central bank was for it, people were for it. So at the risk or without thinking of what this was doing to Turkey in the medium to long term, well, the policy was supported by all different groups of people. But meanwhile, the Turkish economy became extremely dependent on these flows. Meanwhile, again, something was happening in the economy, which was money and investor interest was running away from what we call the real sectors to commerce or construction. All these supermarkets, shopping centers, it's still going on.
But can you explain for non-economists like me and those who might listen to this later on why that was the case, why it was going into those sectors?
Well, it was because the money was there. In other words, it was very unprofitable to invest in, say, manufacturing sector. Of course, there were exceptions. Why was it so unprofitable? First of all, the Turkish manufacturer faces relatively high costs in energy, transportation, etc., compared to the rest of the world. And the interest rate was so high that it just did not make economic sense to put your money in an activity where you are facing very high interest rates and also very high costs of manufacturing, while there were opportunities for other things like commerce,
real estate,
etc. But this was a form or manifestation of almost a Dutch disease. I don't know. I'm sure the economists here are familiar with the Dutch disease, which is sometimes it doesn't help an economy to have access to a lot of resources, sort of windfall resources. And if it so happens, the country's exchange rate gets to a point that the exporters in that country cannot export anymore, but importing is very easy. And therefore, you don't invest in the real sectors anymore. Now, we see this in the petroleum-producing countries all the time. They can't have any manufacturing of any decent size because they don't need it. They can't do it. The money is coming. But that is, in a way, making their long-term growth very risky. Now, in Turkey, what was the windfall gain? The windfall gain was this capital that was coming from abroad. It came in abundance. It just didn't matter if you had this large trade deficits or current account deficits. It was being covered. And therefore, we were moving into a different sort of economic system, so to speak, which in the long run, it was obvious, would hurt Turkey a great deal. However, the world crisis of 2008 and 2009 exposed weaknesses in the Turkish economy. And despite what the government people, especially the prime minister, says regarding how we were little, if any, affected by this crisis, Turkey, I think, not only in my view, but in the view of all those who look at the figures, was a country that was affected the most, maybe, in the first 3 to 5 countries in the world. And again, I go back, if our banking sector had not stood firm, we would have been in much deeper problem. So when we come to 2010, on one hand, we have some issues, some concerns regarding the economy, and I'm aware of it, and I hope we will have a chance to discuss what those concerns are. But I am more concerned, again, as I said earlier, about the medium to long term. Now, still, when the situation gets a little improved, a little better, we again fall back to the old position. We say, that's okay, the current account deficit isn't too much, or we have money coming from such and such place, and we can manage the next 6 months, and once that 6 months is over, we're okay. But that is really a very, I should say, unfortunate way of looking at it. And my one concern is that as things may get a little better, this concern about the future may be dropped altogether. Now, I was talking about growth rates of 3%, 3.5%, 4% in a decade. Now, Turkey cannot go anywhere with these growth rates, given its labor force and all that. And Turkey does have the potential. I mean, don't ask me exactly how I know this, but I guess it's gut feeling or what happened in the past and all that. 6-7% growth should not be Turkey's, beyond Turkey's means. We're seeing this with in other countries as well. And if Turkey is going to alleviate, forget about erasing, but alleviate the unemployment problem, you just can't, Turkey cannot afford anything less than 6%. And 7% should be minimum. But how shall we get there? Not with the policies of the recent past, or sort of muddling through the coming months with money coming here or from there. Now, first and foremost, we have to really find a way to increase the saving ratio in Turkey. It's extremely low. Well, the economists here who are probably dealing with the Turkish economy closer than I do, like 17-18% we talk about, but Turkey should be able to go up to 20-25%. This is how other countries did. Forget about China, that's a tremendous saving rate, but India and a few other countries who have accomplished something in this regard, they went up in the. So we can't do it with these low interest rates supplemented by some money coming from abroad. And the second thing is that we have to find ways to improve productivity and not only by reducing the number of workers employed in any given industry, but other ways, maybe not just a labor productivity, but what economists call total factor productivity. That's the use of all productive factors even more efficiently. Now, my chagrin, if I should put it that strongly, is that in Turkey, we don't have this strategic thinking and this long-term view in any circle. I don't think that the think tanks, whatever they are in Turkey, however weak or strong they are, or the universities, academicians, the newspaper writers, government itself, of course, doesn't have this. And still we prefer these somewhat optimistic projections for the coming year that, for example, with the budget or the medium-term financial plan, very unrealistic revenue targets and very optimistic expenditure targets. And I was reading, was it yesterday or today, that only the added money to the retired people's salaries this year, it will be 3 billion liras. Now, that will more or less take some of it, all of it, of this recent increases in the in taxes and other areas like cigarettes, such as taxes on those items. So I don't want to go much beyond this. I have spoken enough anyway. So these are some of my thoughts, where we are coming. And my conclusion, my strong conclusion from my point of view, is that we cannot go business as usual. We have to find ways to change it with a somewhat more realistic look towards future. And whatever reforms we are contemplating must be geared towards achieving this objective. I'll stop here.
Thank you. You know, Baran Bey reminded me before the meeting today that he has not only come to CSIS meetings as a speaker, but also, as he actually just mentioned himself, also as a participant. And one of the meetings he participated in was exactly 8 years ago, when Tayyip Erdogan and his AK Party delegation came to CSIS. And we weren't in this room, actually. We were in the basement in B1. And he talked about the program of his new party. And I remember he touched on the IMF deal. He was somewhat critical of it, if my memory serves me right. I can't remember if you asked him a question or not, and it was not clear whether, if and when they came to power, which they did 10 months later, they would continue with this. Now, most of the past 8 years, this party has been in office. And once again, we got a discussion of the IMF. Now, why is there renewed interest on the part of the government for an IMF deal that they weren't enthusiastic about just a few months ago? And secondly, is this tied in any way to what I've been reading about in the economic pages of the Turkish newspapers about a liquidity crisis, that there is the funds are drying up somewhat? Could we begin with that, please?
Okay. I'm sure others have views on that too. But
no, please, please join in the discussion now.
Yes. Now, it's quite clear that the government sees 2010 not going to be an easy year in many, many ways. I think I have hinted some of the problems that will arise from, say, the budget and budget performance. But what is happening when we face this kind of a situation? The government goes into the market and starts competing with the other borrowers, with the private sector and all that. This raises the interest rates high, and it cuts the private sector somewhat from the resources they could potentially use. The government uses it up. Now, this, on one hand, raises the interest rate in the market. I mean, we will probably see this in the coming months. And on the other hand, it contributes to inflation pressures. And it also adds the government's borrowing. It adds the government's debt. I sense that the government or the authorities at this point finally realize that the few efforts they made regarding these revenue increases will not be enough for the coming year. And they are not as optimistic about 2010 as they were before. And the growth will not be major. It will be very sluggish. As I said, the best estimates are 3.5%, but it's possible it can come down to. Now, this could be the main reason to have another resource that will help government to carry through some of these programs and expenditures without totally going to the domestic market and borrowing, which will distort the picture a great deal. Now, here, of course, you can add a few other things, which I did not really deliberately get into. It is we are going to see a very interesting year in 2010 politically as well. Now, if it will be a turmoil, as some would expect, this will also affect the economy badly. And I don't think the government is counting on this, so to speak. But again, they probably want to feel more secure with some cushion that would come from abroad that would allow them to provide more liquidity to the market. And therefore, with their borrowing, the need will be less for one thing. The other, that they will put some pressure on the interest rates, I think.
Let me
pursue that before I open the proceedings to questions from the floor. Now, you touched on the political aspects of the decision that will have to be made when it comes to seeking a new agreement with the IMF, which is that the IMF, as always, will have its own, if not conditions, you know, the aspects of the deal. Conditions, of course, is a bad word. Now, we got maximum 18 months to go before the elections are due. And there is speculation that, in fact, the elections may be held this year. No government likes restrictions on its ability to disperse funds in the time-honored way before elections. So on the one side, there are the economic arguments in favor of getting funds from the outside. But on the other side, on the political side, there there are arguments to be made against having restrictions on your ability to use those funds. Now that you touched on the politics of it, can you talk a little bit about that?
I don't know if anybody else would come to.
Please start it, and then I'll open it up to the floor.
Okay. I guess it's a consideration that they have been going through for a long time, because this talk about the IMF agreement or coming to terms with IMF, what has been more than a year now, it's just on, off. Now,
just a few years ago, to interrupt you for a second, the Prime Minister himself said that we're very close to an agreement, which is why we have the speculation.
Yeah, that's right.
Please.
And that's right. We had signals from the government many times that the agreement was imminent and there was just a few little pieces left. But basically, we agree on things and all that. And all that time, I felt personally that the government was hoping, expecting that IMF would go much easier on them, whatever that means, than before. Whereas I presume IMF sort of stuck to its guns on some key issues and all that. Now, if you were a prime minister at this point, what would you do about IMF? That's the key thing. On one hand, true, an IMF program will bring in some restrictions, some curbs, some limits, some ceilings, some of the things they can do. But at the same time, if without IMF money they really go through these ceilings themselves anyway, I think the economy could respond very badly, very poorly to that. In other words, the economic crisis may heighten. So it's a toss-up between the two. And I don't know if Mr. Erdogan's himself making this suggestion is just some messages to let the stock market go up or exchange rate come down, whatever it is. I don't know.
But the Prime Minister had said that we will accept the deal with the IMF, and I'm not translating it literally, if they don't squeeze our throats. So presumably it depends on whether the conditions are that wide-ranging. Floor is now open.
Yeah, but
go ahead.
Matt, go ahead. One more thing, that's all.
Please.
But the IMF, we know in the last year or so, has really relaxed a lot of its very strong sort of conditionality. And according to the speeches of the general manager of IMF and also the experience of a number of countries, IMF was not to really squeeze our, what did you call it?
Throat. I didn't translate literally.
But even it looks like our government could not really take even that. In other words, they wanted a much more relaxed sort of IMF position. Anyway, okay.
The floor is open. If anybody wants to start with this or to go into something else, please go ahead.
Judith Baker, I'm with the State Department in the Economic Bureau, and it's very nice to see you again, Professor Schoencher. Is the timing of this coincidental with the debt rollover in terms of this the IMF gestures towards a new deal, is my question.
It may or may not have, I don't know, I'm not privy to all that, but even without the debt rollover, this has been an issue in the brewing, really.
As we're recording, can you just get the mic in front of us? Sorry.
Yes. Hi. From the World Bank. There was a bond issue yesterday, euro bond issue of about, I believe, 2 billion, right? The interest rate wasn't as low as it was expected. You know, Turkey was recently upgraded by some of the rating agencies, by Fitch, one notch below investment grade. And you would think a much lower, much favorable interest rate for a country rated at the Fitch rating. So perhaps that may have triggered that there is also cheaper money, cheaper alternative. That the possibilities for Turkey to issue more bonds at a favorable rate is maybe perhaps no longer there in the international markets.
Anybody else want to join the discussion on this? Comments, views? Any other questions beyond the IMF? There's a lot of expertise in it. Sibel, please.
Sibel Kulaksis from the World Bank. Baran Bey, you have already mentioned that there is no strategy from the government or from academia on medium-term framework. But is there at least a vision from the government where, on sources of growth? for example, in the next 5 years, when we look at the contributors to GDP, from which sectors should the growth come from, especially when we are losing competitiveness in manufacturing sector? Is there any discussion going on diversification, or is there a vision where whether it should be export-led growth with labor or in labor-intensive sectors, or any thinking on that?
Again, I don't know what they talk among them, themselves, but I don't see any manifestation of such a decision. I mean, our 3-year, what do you call it, financial plan, it's focusing on, rightly so, on the expenditures and resources for a 3-year period at the most. And I'm not really expecting to go back to the planning days where I was part of it in the 60s. It's a different era. But again, you don't even have to have a plan. For example, when Özal was doing his thing, I mean, it wasn't a written plan, but that was a framework there, obviously, opening up the economy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So right now, as I see it, there is no interest in it. I don't know if it's only lack of understanding, lack of appreciation, or what, but when I see, when I hear the dialogue in Turkey in all circles, continuously going around the stock market and exchange rate and the interest rates and all that, that I find it less than healthy. But if there is such a thing, I mean, we have a whole great big planning organization, I suppose some people are there doing some sort of analysis and making some proposals, whatnot, but in any way, I don't see it. I mean, if there's such a thing, it has to be brought forward so everybody understands and everybody makes its decision based on that. What will happen in the future? Like, if employment is a major concern that they will deal with, what policies will help alleviate the unemployment situation? I don't know. But the firms are still finding it very difficult to employ more people for the known reasons. But then, I mean, this can be expanded more about the tax system, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, at least my reading of it is that there isn't sufficient strategic thinking and or sharing it with the public.
This is Koray Ertaş from the Turkish Embassy. I'm a foreign service officer, so talking about political issues, be they are domestic political issues or foreign policy issues, it's more easy. It's easier to talk kind of, let's say, recklessly, you can say, with the very same issue, one thing, but your opponent can say entirely an opposite thing. But on the economic issues, there are the vivid existence of numbers. So since I'm not the expert on economy, I will just try to make the numbers talk and not myself, and try to maybe complement the picture that you gave for the last 10 years. Since we all started to talk about IMF, Turkey to this date has made 17 standby agreements with the IMF, which it did not conclude. But the last IMF deals were the only ones that it had concluded, 17 plus 2. In terms of purchasing power parity, Turkey, as you all know, is the 16th largest economy of the world and 6th in Europe. This may sound, well, so what, but these are important figures. Just recently, since I have personal interest in Bulgaria and I worked over there as well, just recently a minister in Bulgaria said the Turkish government should pay a kind of compensation like $15 billion. Was it 10 or 15 anyway? Because Turkey is, after all, 16th largest economy of the world, so they can pay this amount. So
yeah, but why?
It makes sense.
I don't know.
or the four past alleged grievances?
Yeah, I mean, it's nonsense, of course, because yeah. I didn't go into it. In terms of population figure, we all know that Turkey has a comparative advantage. If you make a comparison between Europe, the number of people within the age group of below 14 is only 16% in Europe, whereas in Turkey it's 28%. Of course, this may also cause or stand as a disadvantage if you cannot use it well. In terms of inflation, as Mr. Baran already suggested, the inflation now seems to stand as 6.5, which is the lowest figure in 40 years. Literally in 40 years, it's the lowest figure. In terms of exports, in the last 9 years, the exports rate increased in Turkey, save the last year, of course, at a rate of 13.9%, whereas the world average was only 5.6%. Exports diversification was also successful in Turkey. In the last 6 years, we also use it as foreign service officers in our political texts. In the last 6 years, the share of our trade volume that we did with our neighbors increased four times. It was 8% of our all trade volume, but now it's 32%. Turkey is now exporting more than 160 countries. In terms of FDI, you also know that the picture is also bright. For instance, from 1995 to 2005, in 10 years, the total FDI to Turkey was 14 billion only. But in the last 3 years, if you again save 2008, the FDI runs at some $20 billion annually. In terms of numbers of foreign companies, for example, in Turkey, the number of foreign companies in Turkey from 1954 to 2002 was only about 5,000. And only in 2003 to 2005, because of the legislative change, it increased in 2 years to more than 11,000, which is more than accumulated in 48 years. Foreign exchange reserves climbed to over $70 billion. Everyone knows what happened to Turkish lira. Six zeros were dropped, and lira surged to its one of its highest levels in like more than 20 years. After the 2001 crisis, serious measures were taken. The new economic program under IMF actually introduced some tight monetary and fiscal policies. That's why, as you rightly suggested, we have now a strong banking sector, which even earned profits even during this crisis year. Of course, these are showing the positive signs of the economy. When you look to the weaknesses, certain unemployment is a very big danger standing over there. But the nice thing in the agriculture in the unemployment picture was that the share of agriculture is diminishing, whereas the services sector is increasing. When talking about unemployment, we also need to take into account the strong or rapid urbanization and rapid increase in the number of young and unemployed people. The second weakness, which is very very strong to my mind, because I'm also dealing on the energy portfolio, is our energy dependency. I just found a figure which is so illustrative. In 2007, the energy bill that was paid by the Turkish government was about 35 billion. That's the bill that we paid for gas or oil or natural gas. If in 2007 we had the 2002 prices, the same bill would have been only $12 billion. This shows the volatility or the dependence to outside factors of the economy itself. And on the tax issue also, we have serious problems. We couldn't, unfortunately, enlarge the tax bases, and we couldn't prevent the tax evasions. This is, again, a point that needs to be dealt with. And finally, of course, we have to deal with the debts of the municipalities and public sector enterprises, SEEs. So, of course, the picture that I gave in it presents some promises, but also it presents some weaknesses as well. I just wanted to make this intervention just to make to the balance picture.
The picture better.
No, to make it maybe more clear and to outsiders to get maybe a fuller picture. Of course, we don't know what the coming years will show us, but as far as I just learned yesterday, the recent projection of the OECD for the next year and the year later is that Turkey will be second fastest growing country within the OECD in the next year, and the other year it will be the first fast growing. This is the OECD, I think, expectation.
I don't get that either.
No, not this year, I mean. I'm talking about...
For next year.
For next year, yeah.
Yeah, OECD
growth, sure. Talking about OECD 30.
Yeah. And also, I mean, you know, when I work at the World Bank, and we always, you know, I'm responsible for...
Can you hit the microphone, please?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Or move the other.
What we like to do is when I present a country to my colleagues, I can tell many positive developments and many negative developments, but it's very important to compare it, you know, and also to talk about when that happened. A lot of the positive developments happened in Turkey during a very benign environment. You know, there is a large global liquidity, you know, low interest rates, and so it was in the sense that, you know, I agree with all these positive developments, but they also happened in a very positive environment. It happened pretty much every single country I worked on as well, and some of them actually were in the crisis even before that, but. I think the problem with Turkey is that Turkey sort of entered the crisis sort of with very high debt rates. So that's a big problem for us because we have to borrow now, and our debt rates will probably exceed 100% of GDP, and that will probably be not a very positive development. I mean, not to, you know, not to obviously.
No, of course. I mean,
but
I
just
also tried to give the right picture. Sure.
But it was, I think it was useful for Councillor Aktaş to do this. But, you know, let me push you a little bit on this, on what I think needs to be the follow-up to it. Okay, the figures look great, right? And you, as a Foreign Service officer, have to, of course, put the positive slant on it. Even if in the worst days of 2000, 2001, 2002, your predecessors were saying nice things about how the situation was not as bad as it seems, and I fully respect that. But, you know, compared to just a few years ago, there are more signs of alarm relating to the Turkish economy than there were before. I mean, surely you're picking that up as well. And what a colleague from the World Bank mentioned, you can make a positive case about almost any country just looking at the figures. And then when you delve into the figures, or go into the figures, to use the Americanism, then that's where you discover the problems. You touched on unemployment, for example. Look, people are talking about how 10% unemployment will mean a disaster for President Obama and his Democratic Party in the midterm elections. We're talking about, what, 16% in Turkey? Now, this government came into office in 2002 on the back of an economic disaster. I think the coalition committed political suicide by going into those elections in the midst of an economic crisis. And I think that this government knows that if it goes into elections with those high unemployment figures, and the real unemployment figures, I suspect, are even higher, and when we take underemployment into account, that could be devastating for any party that's in government, notwithstanding all those fine figures that you mentioned. Go ahead, and then do them. Yeah, no.
Just a little point. It's actually a global fact. In every country, economy is actually the driving factor that establishes the fate of the governments. As I said, I worked on Central Europe a couple of times on political portfolios, and in each of the countries, be it Slovakia or be it Bulgaria or Hungary, all the governments are coming with strong votes, with strong popular support, but then when the people see that their economic situation is not changing, they're coming, they're just going with the same haste, let's say. So I agree with you, the economy is a driving factor almost in every country. That will establish the fate of the governments. So
one
we'll
more
see.
Point before I give the floor to Dudanam from the top office in Washington. In the last elections, though, in the general elections, the economy was not the main issue. It was another issue.
Yeah.
But in the upcoming elections, if the economy is the main issue, whichever government is in office pays a price. To Daniela, no, please.
Thank you. Maybe a little side topic, but I was reading a recent article online, and they did a study in the United States. This is, I believe, near the end of the year or at the very beginning, and they published the statistics. Obviously, the U.S., just like Turkey, is also facing major unemployment, and it's troubling even for this country. But the statistics were showing that despite how bad things are, you only have 20% of the employed population that are happy with their jobs. There's like 60% of the people that are unhappy with their jobs. And if you ask them, do you think you'll be where you are a year from now, you have a very small amount of people that are saying, yes, I will be where I am a year from now. So not only do we have unemployed people, but we have unhappy employed people. I'd like to get your comment on this from a Turkish perspective. At the same time, I have another question that's somewhat related, and that is, you know, moments of crises are times for extraordinary opportunities. In the United States, you know, there's a recent movie, and it kind of makes fun of the situation, when you're in an economic crisis and people are being fired or they're quitting their jobs, you have a lot of entrepreneurs that are, you know, showing up, and they have their own businesses. And right now with the internet, obviously, a lot of e-businesses, people are becoming millionaires in a year or two. If you have a bright idea, you go with it and you have something. And I know Top President, whenever he gives speeches here and elsewhere, he talks about the similarities between Turks and Americans, and that the entrepreneurial spirit is shared by Turks as well. Do you see this happening in Turkey? Do you think that this is where the answer lies in Turkey? You know, with more entrepreneurs starting their own businesses, especially at a time where there's unemployment or unhappy people at their jobs, is this an option?
Ceren Özer from the World Bank. This is only based on anecdotal kind of and my observations when I go and visit Turkey. But I was quite astonished to see that a lot of people from neighboring countries are now coming to Turkey and seeking employment, like Bulgaria, Moldova, Armenia. I work on Nepal for my work at the World Bank, and we, for example, there, because of remittances, see the reservation wage of the local population going up. I'd like to get your insights whether, in the case of Turkey, on top of the unemployment problem, is there maybe related to the safety net issue or in general about whether people are being picky about jobs, how much of it is about basically a reservation wage being relatively higher than it should be? That's my question.
Starting from what you last said, well, I think what's saving the Turkish unemployed is the strong family ties and their strong relations with their origin. In a different country, without these ties, I think it would be much more manifested and much more disastrous. If you don't see people dying on the streets, whatever, it's the Turkish tradition that the families and friends help, most of the families help. Now, these unemployment figures in Turkey, they're the official figures. I respect them and all that, but there are some issues with that. I don't want to go into it. Moreover, each time they come up with these figures, they also change the so-called labor participation rate or the female participation rate. So many people who lost interest in finding a job, they don't record themselves as unemployed anymore. They're not looking for jobs. There's no hope. So you're right, there are many very low-paying jobs now taken up by those who come from the neighboring countries, whatnot. Now, two reasons. One is that the situation in those countries are totally intolerable, not only worse, but intolerable. You find a physician from Moldavia come in, be a house servant. It's just...
Can I interrupt you for a second? Did you say Bulgarians?
Bulgarians are coming, even though they're in the EU, for jobs in Turkey? I find that amazing.
I don't know.
I've actually, again, it's sort of anecdotal, but in construction sector, for example, I've seen it. But it might be maybe also seasonal, right? So they might just come in for 2-3 months.
It just occurred to me when Baran was answering.
But I think maybe Armenia and Moldova are like the better examples of this situation, and there might be more. I mean, I thought it was interesting. My parents had a little home improvement, and for example, they had university students from Africa who were temping as like sort of laying ground material to the house. So it's very interesting.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's bound to happen. I mean, Turkey, of course, better off than most countries around it, but it's the expectation is different, obviously. Now, about the question regarding people who are employed, are they happy or unhappy? I don't have statistics for this, but I can assure you that it would not be just like in the West. These days, I think anybody who has a little job, however low-paying it is, would be quite happy, would be quite pleased, I think. Well, I'm in my case. No, I'm speculating.
I think this says a lot more about America than it does about anywhere else.
Probably. And your point regarding the entrepreneurs and all that, right? Now, this is an aspect I don't even want to get into at all because it's a very broad issue in Turkey. Who is benefiting from these opportunities and all these cultural, religious affiliations and all that? It's just a Pandora's box. I don't want to even open it here.
Why don't you just open it up and look inside?
If it gets out of here.
Calvinists.
I mean, in addition to the changes that are taking place that I summarized, and you also summarized it from a little more optimistic perspective and all that, just sort of not touching base even, who are the winners in Turkey and who are the losers and why and how it will happen. Granted that there will be those who benefit from this kind of crisis in every country, in every society, but if you want to address the issue in its entirety, you just have to go a little deeper and penetrate, you know, through this veil, so to speak, so how the business is taking place in Turkey, who is employing who for what reason, and who is getting rich, who is not getting rich, who is encouraged as an investor or entrepreneur, who is discouraged. That's another issue. But in general, of course, you can see that every problem creates an opportunity. But in Turkey, I don't see much of it yet. Now, regarding the points you have made, I don't want to get back to them because it's just a matter of glass half full, half empty sort of business. But with the IMF programs, I want to comment. True, Turkey has fulfilled the requirements of 2 standby arrangements. My issue is not that those programs were carried out or not carried out. My issue is that Turkey relied as if those were the only guiding principles for a long period of time. I mean, IMF programs are for restoring economic stability, et cetera, et cetera. Now, Turkey just continued with those policies forever. I mean, IMF policies are not there to sort of provide you a framework or encourage you to look ahead of the time and all that. They have accomplished what they were prepared for, and also the government should be commended that they have done successfully. They have gone through 2 programs. I mean, it's said. But enough is enough. I mean, after that, we have to find new vistas, new openings, new strategies. That's the point I wanted to raise. So population advantage is another difficult issue. I claim to be a population specialist, too, among a few other things. It's just I don't want to get into it. It's just a very different thing. But in a nutshell, Turkey is missing an opportunity at present, I don't mean today or yesterday, I mean a longer period, which helps countries really benefit from this kind of population growth. And the time is running out in Turkey. Population growth has become a burden on the Turkish economy, whereas it could have been a window of opportunity. So that is the big issue. We were unable to use that. I don't mean by that this government or that government, but as a economy, as a society as a whole, we have not and we are not benefiting from the fruits of a certain type of population growth. And as you, I'm sure, know, that the demographic change is such that we won't ever have it again in our country's time. Let me not get into other points. It's just a matter of interpretation.
We're coming to the end of the program. I'm going to come to you, Robin, in a second, but you put up your hand. Go ahead.
Hi, Onur Özlü from the World Bank. I just have a quick question. I think this is about the hidden economy in Turkey and about the non-ability of every single government, including this one, for a long time to widen the tax base. It amazes me every single time I go back to Istanbul and see the hidden economy take place. It just fascinates me. And the most recently, my sister, who's a single parent, employs two domestic help at her household. And the average salary that she pays them is roughly $2,000 every month.
And she, or both of them?
No, combined. She says this is very cheap compared to Turkish labor. If she had to hire them, she would have to pay Social Security, retirement, and other benefits. And when I talk to her friends, because because my background is in finance, I try to look at the global picture in Istanbul. Just in Istanbul, the amount of money that is paid to illegal immigrants and therefore in the hidden economy that's not taxed is close to $1 billion, probably a month. So this is an enormous, or annually. It depends on how you look at it, but if you consider that there are 500,000 households that are middle income that on average pay $2,000 a month, that adds up to about $100 million a month. So you can multiply that. It depends on how you look at it, but it is a large amount of money. And this excludes construction. This includes any other larger – this is just household economy. So either the political affairs people from the government or – yourself, why is there such an inability to widen the tax base in Turkey? What's withholding this?
That's not a massive issue for you.
How much time do we have?
Next 4 hours. Go ahead.
No, it's a very difficult issue. However, sometimes, maybe cynically, I feel like it's this economy that's saving Turkey, this so-called hidden economy. How? Because it is providing some flexibility in the labor that we don't have. So you hire and fire these people, so it's like in this country almost without much obligation you can do that. So the businessman can do that. Two, it's cheap. It really is. It's cheap. If you add them to the labor force, unionized labor force, I think without changing the laws drastically, the burden on the economy would be much, much higher. I'm not supporting the idea that there should be a hidden economy, but those of us, when we talk about the problems with the hidden economy, sometimes we forget the fact that unless you really do something substantial, hidden economy will be there and does serve a purpose, especially at time of crisis.
When we look, there's the economy, then there's the gray economy, and then there's the black, or if you like, hidden economy. And in one of today's newspapers, there's a man sitting in a Dutch jail who claims that, what is it, $20 billion or $30 billion came into the economy through illegal enterprises in 1994, 1995 that saved that particular government. Clearly, you know, that takes the discussion into its absurdities. But can you give a percentage for the gray or the black economy compared to the green economy?
Depends on who estimates that. I have seen figures as high as 40%.
Is that for the gray and black or just...
No, this is gray and black both.
Gray and black. That's almost half the economy.
Almost.
And that's untaxed, is the point that was being made.
Try to tax them. It just changes the whole system altogether.
So how can you construct, you know, how can you make sound economic policies for an economy, half of which is beyond the control of the government?
Why should the government control that?
I mean, I used the wrong word. But I used the wrong word, but you know what I mean. Have access to
the attention of the government.
Accepts the attention of the government in terms of taxes and so on. I mean, beyond, you know, that basically regulates itself. I mean, it's a serious question.
Oh, yeah, I know. It has its rules and regulations and all that, but I don't think that's the issue number one in Turkey. We have so many other big issues. And I would rank the presence of this gray economy as the main hindrance. I wouldn't.
In fact, you said that saved Turkey to some extent.
I was being a little facetious. I mean, it's not really. I mean, it saves the country, but it does at times come to the rescue.
We are just past our time, but Grob, you're going to have the final question, but there's one follow-up to this. Go ahead. Please, but you put the mic, and then we're going to go to Rob.
We tax consumption in Turkey, so they pay value-added tax, so they do have contribution.
You're right.
They don't buy taxes. So they don't pay income taxes, but they...
That's in the gray, but not in the black economy.
Yes. Yeah.
And by which I mean also illegal activities of the kind that this man sitting in the Dutch jail was talking
about. Perhaps they also pay taxes.
If they're buying in the market, they pay taxes.
Yeah. Rob,
shares an important
final point. Get a mic, if you can.
I'd like to get back. What's that?
I know. Okay. Can you say it for the mic?
Oh, yeah. Rob Keane, CSIS Turkey Project. I'd like to get back to the point that Duden raised earlier about entrepreneurship in Turkey. I know I haven't spent as much time in Turkey as just about everyone in this room. But with my experience there, and I don't mean to be disparaging, I found it to be a very bureaucratic country. I mean, just to move into a dorm room at a university, I believe I had to sign and stamp 6 different documents, including passport photos and all sorts of things like that. So the question that I would raise is, if people in the U.S. are trying to take advantage of this crisis to start their own businesses and have, you know, sort of more rewarding, you know, entrepreneurship opportunities, is that even available to people in Turkey? I mean, how much time does it take? You know, I think it takes on average something like 7 or 9 days to set up a business in the U.S. I've heard it takes, you know, something like 90 days to do the same in Pakistan. So how does Turkey compare on that front in terms of issues like taxes and Social Security and you know, getting all the forms signed and stamped and things like that?
Well, just the brief answer to that is, of course, you have an important point, but I thought when she spoke about entrepreneurship, it's not setting up factories or anything. It's just to be resourceful, to be, you know, doing a little something without going through the government mechanisms and all that. You see a lot of those people in Turkey, all the way from street vendors up to constructors, construction people and all that. So I thought that's not what she meant.
No, it's closer to what
you mean.
Oh,
I see.
Start
This would be a terrible time. I wouldn't.
Well, I can sort of answer your question. I think it is about a week to set up a company in Turkey. I mean, yes, there is a lot of bureaucracy for sure, but there's bureaucracy here too, you know. But I think it's about a week to set up a company. So that's 6 days.
If I might add off the record something, it's so easy to open a foreign company in Turkey. But now we had problems to close the companies. Really. But it's indeed quite easy now. Less than a week you can open with the existing laws. But there's a loophole, unfortunately, in terms of getting out of the country.
All right. With that, we come to the end of a fascinating discussion. Thank you, Bayram Bey, and we look forward to having you back here again. And I'm very happy that we actually looked at the Turkish economy here at CSIS again. It's been a while, and frankly, with the elections coming up, I think we should be looking more and more at the economy and what the implications it may have for the political scene. Thank you very much. Thank you.